Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who always packs mustard whenever there's a natural disaster coming towards him. It's John Levingood.
Well, I mean, you know, for the hot dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, who doesn't love hot dogs?
I mean, you know, they're great. I think somebody got in trouble because they were selling like $40 hot dog water to people.
Did you say hot dog water?
Yeah, I read something and then I extrapolated that information. But I guess if you type in hot dog water for $40, you'll see it.
That sounds horrible. Wait, did it come from a natural hot dog water spring?
Yes, it did. Yeah, and, you know, in Germany, there are hot dog springs.
This is how they make Bavarian beer. They use hot natural hot dog water springing from the soil.
Have you ever noticed the meaty taste to some of the beer?
I mean, it's got a lot of body. You can damn near chew it.
Yep, that's hot dogs. German hot dog beer.
And like a good hoppy beer, it stores for a very long period of time because it's mostly nitrates. Yep.
And, you know, Hefeweizen is German for hot dog beer.
I figured it was.
Yeah. I mean, everyone knows that.
I don't even know why we're saying that. I mean, yeah, everyone knows that.
Yeah, like that's kind of like saying, hey, you know, 2 + 2 = 4.
And dogs are animals.
Oh, man. We're blowing minds here at Movies. I know. All right. So I'm excited, John.
Why are you excited? What's happening?
We're going to talk about a movie that I feel it's become a punchline. This movie has become a punchline.
Very fair.
A few weeks ago, I wrote a 10-year anniversary piece about it, and then we kind of said, hey, let's podcast about it. And so we've been spending more time with it lately, kind of watching it. I've been reading a lot more interviews, researching it. It's interesting. This movie, you know, as we talked about, I've read through all my stuff. We're going to talk about The Happening. You see under the title. Full spoilers. We're going to wreck everything from a movie that happened 10 years ago. But there's a lot to talk about in this movie. And what I'm most excited about is that I don't think you and I are going to sit here going, that scene was stupid. There's a lot to unpack. There's a lot of earnestness. There's M. Night Shyamalan swung and missed. He was following up somewhat, I wouldn't say a disaster, but he hit big with Sixth Sense. Unbreakable, everyone loves today. It wasn't that commercially successful. Signs skyrocketed him into the A-list. The Village, tons of people went and watched, but that kind of opened up the door for some criticism. Lady in the Water was a mind-boggler of a adult fairy tale that I need to watch again. And so he was kind of on thin ice with people. I think he had a couple misfires. People were kind of annoyed with him. And he comes out with the R-rated The Happening. Like, I don't know what's going through his brain where he's in need of a hit movie, and he comes out with The Happening, a movie where it's a mind-boggler. But I love it.
So I don't want to get too far into it right now because one of our listener questions is going to get me going about it. But I mean, all his movies are very different. And say what you want about it. Like, a lot of people hate this movie. I'm not going to call it a bad movie. I love this movie. It's not a great film, but it's highly, highly entertaining. And almost all the dumb stuff in it, like, I don't get angry at. I don't want to shred it. I want to celebrate making fun of it and picking at it, but it's like I'm fine with all of it. I kind of find it to be a step above Jupiter Ascending. It aims really high. It's really ambitious. It covers a lot of ground. It has great vision, but the execution lost a lot of people, but won a lot of people. And I think we're just in the win category. We came up and gave it a hug.
I have a theory about it after reading one interview that he did, and that's all I could find about this movie he did with CNN.
Okay.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist, and we're going to get to the question soon, but in this interview, he said it's going to be one of the greatest B movies ever made. I've read some articles where people are like, oh, he's full of crap, he's a liar.
He said that?
Yes. So
that's what I thought. I love that. I'm sorry, keep going.
some people, though, were like, oh, this is crap, he saw the movie, and he was doing damage control. This movie comes from a guy whose films are meticulous. He carried Sixth Sense until the end, Unbreakable, Signs. If you look at Lady in the Water, he told that movie with a purpose, and even if people didn't like the ending, he was in full control. So when I watch this movie, The Happening, I don't think it's an accident, the final product. I don't think this movie, he just wasn't working. I mean, when you watch his actors, they're all heavily directed in all of his films. They know what style he wants. He directs them how he wants. So I think he was going for a B movie because that's what I think. And I also think there's heavier themes in it, but I guess we can unpack those as we get further into the podcast.
So how would you describe this movie? If you were to give it a synopsis, a one line? What's the explanation for the people going into this?
The happening starts with people. They start repeating themselves. They stop completely. Then they commit suicide with hairpins, jumping off buildings. Then it cuts to our lead characters, led by Mark Wahlberg, and Alma, played by Zooey Deschanel. And the rest of the movie is just them trying to survive. They leave New York for Philly. They stop before they get to Philly. And then they realize that they have to get away from people. So the more people, the more attacks. But the wind keeps attacking the smaller groupings. So then it becomes a chase film where they're trying to escape the wind. And it's 90 minutes, and it's over before you know it.
Yeah, it was pretty, oh gosh, I'm going to say breezy, and it wasn't an intended dad joke.
It goes by fast.
So we've got a few listener questions, and I feel like we're already on the trajectory of answering into them. But Dan Robinet, who's a filmmaker, actually, I reviewed one of his short films called Tethered, which I really liked at Shriekfest. Dan asks, where am I? And what's happening? And I think that we're really already digging deep into that kind of B-plus movie mania of what's happening. I don't know if you want to add anything for Dan.
I think his reaction is perfect, because if you were thinking you were going to go see this, remember when the movie came out, the trailers, it just showed the suicide and people running and Mark Wahlberg, who was an action star at the time, and you're like, whoa, this movie's going to be...
All I remember is the lawnmower.
Yeah, this movie
from the trailer.
Yeah. This is going to be an R-rated horror film, Final Destination, Mark Wahlberg action movie. And then it basically ends in an anticlimax. Like, he doesn't battle the wind. He doesn't spin kick the wind. He doesn't shoot the wind. It just happens for a day, then it stops. It's a piece that starts with all the suicide, then gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So, and it gets weirder and weirder and weirder and weirder. So you're sitting in the audience and you're expecting what the trailer showed. You know, the movie poster said, oh, a thrill ride, you know, all that kind of stuff. You're going to be in the theater going, what just happened? Who am I? Where am I? Why? Huh? And I think it confused a lot of people.
So I will say, when I saw this in theaters, 27 years old at the time, and I was kind of thrilled by it, but my thrill was kind of a hyper exhilarated B plus movie exhilaration, where I'm just looking over at whoever was next to me, like, really, like, what is happening in this movie? Like every time something happens, I'm just like, really? Like, what? Like, so it was very fun for me. It was very engaging. I probably made fun of it more then, but I was also a jerky 27-year-old. That's just what jerky 27-year-olds do. I look at it now, and again, I find I want to celebrate the sillier aspects of it. But yeah, it's like, and speaking of what's happening, I guess, do you know, Mark, did M. Night have more or less freedom on this than he did in his previous five films?
He had the same amount of freedom.
It was the same? Okay.
Because Lady in the Water, The Village, even though that kind of kicked the door open for criticism, made a ton of money. Ton. Lady in the Water, financially successful. This guy, even though his movies were getting a little clunky, he still had the freedom to do what he wanted. And on this movie, he told the studio, I'm making a 90-minute movie. I'm going to shoot it really fast. We're going to move on steady cams, and I'm going to make this a 90-minute B-movie. And he got the idea by driving from New York to Philly one day and seeing wind blow through the trees. So it wasn't to the – and also, if he had less control in this movie would have been ripped from his hands. They would have been like, you have gone crazy, and Ron Howard's going to finish it.
Oh.
Which is fine, but it would have been a weird hybrid. So at this point, he was still peak M. Night Shyamalan.
So I've got a follow-up question kind of to that theme. This one is from John F. Leonard, a kind of productive writer. You can find his stuff on Amazon. He's always sharing our stuff all over the place on Twitter. But
good man.
So John F. Leonard asks, why did they let him make it? Now, I feel like we started to crest into that. Right. His filmography at this point for direction and writing was Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, Signs, The Village, Lady in the Water. And then we roll into this. And people can say what they want about those films. I actually love all of them. Of course, I'm putting Sixth Sense and Unbreakable at the top, but I love the ending of The Village that apparently upset a lot of people. Lady in the Water was so deliberately weird with a straight face with is his name Freddie Rodriguez, Freddie Gonzalez, who had the one big arm and the one little arm. I mean, he tells you the weirdest stuff with a straight face. And I loved the fairy dust he was sprinkling on this weird, modern, tortured Paul Giamatti, which is almost every Paul Giamatti role. But like, and then he brought us yet something different from all of his other things, which were always subsequently radically different from everything he'd done before. I think he earned this.
Yeah, and the budget was somewhere between $48 million and $60
million. For this?
Yeah, and if you think about the movies that were coming out in 2008, The Dark Knight, Iron Man, Hulk, there were some very, like Tropic Thunder almost was $90 million. So this budget was by no means massive for M. Night Shyamalan. So it was lower, actually, than a few of his. And with his track record and with his still kind of red hotness, they had no problem getting it. It made $170 worldwide. This movie made $170 million worldwide just on M. Night's name. So that shows he probably could have, I don't know, made a movie about, you know, deadly farts.
And good. And that's what earned him to move on to Devil, where farts are most deadly.
Yeah, exactly.
In the elevator.
How horrible would that be? You're being hunted by Satan and then someone just lets loose in an elevator.
Dude, I'll bet Lucifer has the worst farts.
Did you say Lucifer?
Let's Lucifer.
Oh, brother. Sorry, guys. We went to a farting thing. But no, yeah, this movie, I think he made a mistake by going here with this movie. I think in his head, this is the funniest movie ever made or a very good movie, but the audience just went over their heads because it wasn't marketed right. It was like a Guillermo del Toro movie almost with like Crimson Peak where it's just not marketed right. People aren't expecting that. So yeah, but the studio at the time made money on this. So I mean, they're totally fine.
Okay, and before we start really digging our heels into this movie, Sarah and Clinton from Huntsville, Alabama, ask, why did they cast Mark Wahlberg?
Red hot at the time. I think he wanted to work with M. Night Shyamalan, and he did an interview where he said, I don't like The Happening. He's like, but I took it because M. Night Shyamalan let me be a science teacher. He's like, I'm stuck in all these movies where I'm this, I'm that. And I think his earnestness blends well with this movie. I do think the way he's directed and the line readings, which are deliberate, hurt him, but he wanted to do something different. I think M. Night Shyamalan saw what the character had, saw that he had that vision. And if you know, people say some stuff, but if you look at I Heart Huckabee's Three Kings, Fear, which you brought up the other day, he is capable of good, earnest performances, not just stuff in Four Brothers or The Fighter, which he's great in. He is capable of what he did here.
So I'm going purely with geography. In 2007, a year before this film, he was in We Own the Night, which is New York City, where Central Park is, which is where our movie is going to open. In 2006, he was in The Departed, Boston, also Northeast metropolis, and the third biggest Northeast metropolis, Philadelphia. In 2006, he starred in Invincible, which is where our movie has our main character start. I think that it is geography destined in his movie roles, or it's just a stupid little thing that I noticed on IMDb, that three of his four movies before this were in the three biggest cities in the Northeast area that was affected in the beginning of the movie.
I think that makes total sense. At least that's 28% of his reasoning. 28 to 39% of his reasoning.
I like how you came up with those facts and figures.
I mean, it has to be. I mean, you know, he loves being around home. So, he had, you know, Philly. He had a Philly thing for a while. Philly, New York.
Isn't that where Sixth Sense took place?
Yeah, well, M. Night grew up in Philly, so all of his movies are in that Pennsylvania area. Filbert. They take place in Filbert.
Does anyone even know where that is?
I like how they show a sign of it, where they're at. Then he goes, where are we?
Yeah, science your way out of that one.
Good old Filbert. But I tell you, man, after watching this again, do you want to jump into it? Are we good on the questions?
Yeah, we've got much more later, but we have We've handled our early questions.
Now, I have a theory about this movie that I got by watching it again. And actually, I was reading an article by Slash Film where they think that Alma, Zooey Deschanel's character, is an alien because just the way she reacts to everything. And I started thinking, nobody really acts like real humans in this movie. You have the officer that says, oh, cheese and crackers. You have the guy that's right. obsessed with hot dogs who pulls out a hot dog in the middle of a roadside already cooked in a bun. You have, you know, weird math going on with John Leguizamo. You have characters, Mrs. Jones, behaving in ways that are bonkers. You have children getting shot in the head. I just have a theory that this is an alternate timeline Earth. I don't
where we've all been replaced by pod people.
I don't think M. Night Shyamalan. It's based in New York and Philly, but I think it's an alternate timeline.
So I will offer an alternative hypothesis.
Sure.
And that is that. And I didn't think of this until just now. And that is that everything that is the happening that happens in this movie, perhaps this is the precursor to the happening. And everyone thinks it hasn't happened yet until people die, when really they're already afflicted. And then when it kind of hits a critical mass of some sort, like maybe people were just start already acting weird.
It's been happening.
No, I mean, maybe it all just started earlier that day. Maybe everyone was exposed, almost like a primer, if you will. Like, oh, I just got stung by the bee. It's swelling. But then a little later, your allergic reaction really starts kicking in.
Oh, so there was...
Or maybe it's cumulative. Over time, it accumulates in you.
Well, I'm allergic to shellfish, so... You know, they say it gets worse and worse the more...
I mean, you touch it to your lips and it tingles. You put it in your mouth and spit it out and you swell up. You swallow it. You're done.
Done. So, I mean, I like that idea. That's... What about everyone just got hit at the same time and it just took everyone later at different times to get hit? And the wind is totally fine.
I mean, maybe it just wasn't windy anywhere in the Northeast when the day started. So everyone just had a resting state of exposure. And then as the wind picked up and started afflicting major areas or something, all of a sudden they were hitting their critical mass.
Got it.
But honestly, I think that your hypothesis makes more sense. It's easier to explain than mine.
Because people don't behave in human ways in this movie.
Most of the time, no. The little girl comes the closest, I think. And actually the two boys, the two teenagers that we're going to meet over the course of the plot.
Yeah, and then they turn into a gang. Now, I want to say, there's just two more things I want to get into before we jump into this movie. Someone said that this movie is about depression, where you start and you kind of alienate yourself from everybody, but then you realize once you've alienated yourself that it's still happening here. It's like an interesting thing about closing yourself off in depression. I'm not saying it's correct, but it's also an interesting theory about how, you know, you move away from people, then you move away from more people, then you're... But it's still the same. You're still having the happening. It's still going to happen. I thought that was an interesting thing that I read on Den of Geek. And then I have one more thing that is really good. Oh, this movie. I think that M. Night Shyamalan knew what he was doing, because if you watch the beginning of this movie, there's so many tight shots, right? When all the teachers are talking, when they get together, tight shot. When people are on the trains, when people are in the restaurant, you don't see much of the world. But as they get more and more alienated, you start getting more wide shots, which could be budget because you don't want to show a lot in cities as opposed to being out in the country. But once you start getting out in the open, and then the end, when it ends with that nice wide shot, like, he built to that. Like, him and Tak Fujimoto, who did Silence of the Lambs and Devil, great cinematographer, that's not an accident. So that's another reason why I don't think this movie was a total failure. I think he meant to make it like this.
Just reminded me of the cinematography in Devil. What a cool movie.
Yeah, it's very good. And I also thought and I also wonder how much Mark Wahlberg actually spent on this movie, because there's a lot of one shots with him where, you know, at the end when he's in that little bunker, when he's looking at stuff, when he's reacting, there's just a lot of, he's very rarely is he in the shot with another person. He is in multiple parts with Zoe and everything, but I wonder if in an effort to save time, they just shot him in a lot of stuff and then turned around on the other person. That means he got out sooner.
Hmm.
I don't know. I'm going into nerdy movie stuff, but do you want to jump into the film?
Amen. So we open in Mark Wahlberg's science class.
Oh, no, we open in...
I'm sorry, you're right. We open in Central Park.
People clawing themselves that we get off screen.
So, yeah, these two women are talking on a park bench in Central Park. One of them starts to act kind of funny, basically repeats herself, and ultimately removes a damn ninja assassin stabby thing from her hair.
Hairpin?
Yeah, but that was like a deadly chopstick or something that you'd see in a shinobi movie. And she just gouges herself in the throat. It was actually kind of brutal for not being gory.
It was very brutal. They just showed the neck and then showed it going in.
And that was our first on-screen happening.
And then we moved to a construction site.
Boy, that was also people just start falling in intervals, big intervals from the roof of a building, these construction workers. And man, when that body hit, like I like tightened up. And then when the next body hits and the leg like hits the side of the dumpster, or that was the third body, I was just like, oh, it's brutal.
Yeah. And the reaction of the workers too, they were like, those guys were about to cry seeing their buddies dead.
Dude, that construction worker who first crouched down and said, like, give him some space, and then you see him looking up as the bodies start coming down, that guy had the best acting in the movie.
Yeah, and he had tears rolling down his eyes. I'm like, give this guy a mini Oscar.
I think that scene is what led to the suicide off the top of the building in Devil.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Opened the movie Devil. That so brutal cool. Fall, yeah. And then, like, the truck slid. But, yes, yeah, so, I mean, that was pretty – those were some intense scenes.
And then we smash cut to Mark Wahlberg talking about bees missing.
Guys, millions of bees are just disappearing off the face of the earth. What are we going to do without all these bees? Albert Einstein said we only got 4 years if we lose all the bees.
What about the honey?
It's like, what am I going to put in my tea? Yo, it's a joke, man. I don't even drink tea. I'm Mark Wahlberg.
And then he asks one of his students who has a perfect-looking face even though he's 15. And the kid just goes, I don't know. Maybe it's just an act of nature that we'll never fully understand and we're never meant to.
Dude, that was so deep. It was like he was possessed.
And I'm like, that's the movie.
That is the movie. That is almost like our opening and closing line.
We will never be able to understand this movie.
No, but we will try in the next 90 minutes. We will absolutely try to. But so this is one of those moments where, like, I've got to remove myself from John the Entomologist and just be John the guy who's watching a movie, because there's 3,500 species of bees in the United States.
Maybe they're all missing.
I don't think we'd know. Most of them have been suppressed because of the disastrous effect that honeybees have had on our nature's ecology. But it's just a funny thing. It's like he's talking about bees. When people talk about bees, they're really referring to honeybees. But we have over 3,000 species of bees.
This movie moves along way too fast for that.
It does a lot of stuff, and it's cool because whatever. We're probably teaching ninth grade science and we're not an entomologist. But so he's talking about it though, and he's making his good points, and the bees have apparently disappeared.
Yeah.
Like from the world over the course of a week or so. And I guess that would be pretty alarming if that actually happened.
They're like the dolphins from Hitchhiker's Guide before that. You know, the world blew up when the dolphins left.
Yep, they knew.
Thanks for all the fish.
They were just, yep, they were done. And so, but I mean, this brings me to something. This never gets answered. Where are all the bees? This is my question.
They were trying.
Where did all the bees actually go?
They were trying out for Jerry Seinfeld's movie, Bees.
Where are all the bees?
What's with all the lampshades?
And why are these all empty hives?
That's never answered. No, I mean, would John, if all the bees went to a certain place, like let's say they went, screw this, we're going to Nebraska. Nebraska would know.
Well, we'd all know. Because as they converge towards Nebraska, every surrounding state would see these like hazy, darkened skies blotted out by trillions of bees flying in mass.
Maybe I think they're just laying low.
Like, it'd be super obvious.
Laying low. I got to say something, though, John. By watching Mark Wahlberg's class in this movie, those kids were well-behaved. I taught science, high school science, for 2 months one time because one of the other teachers had a heart attack, so I had to fill in. So I had to teach myself science every night before I taught these kids. They were a lot better than my students.
I taught college-level students for 8 years, and these kids are better behaved than PhD students.
Yeah, they love Mark Wahlberg.
He's just like, okay, guys, let's all calm down. The principal's here, and everyone's just like, psh.
But he seems to know his students pretty well, and he engages discussion with them.
He's the younger, cool teacher who doesn't have to try too hard, so he actually is liked. You know, there's like a 25-year-old teacher who tries too hard, but now that he's like, I don't know, 30, 32, 35 maybe in this one. I have no idea.
I'd say 35, yeah.
Like, I mean, he's still like a younger-ish teacher, and he's probably a snazzy enough looking guy. You know, he's pretty cool with them. So I guess, you know, he's earned his street cred with them.
Also, they know him. These are older kids, and maybe they know he's such a dork that they aren't like, oh yeah, Mr.
Wahlberg.
Yeah, Wahlberg. Elliot in this movie. He's just kind of like, remember when he gets the vice principal comes up to him and he's like, come with me. And all the students are like, ooh.
Ooh. Come on, guys. Yeah, you got to hush down. The principal's here.
Knock it off.
like he's talking to his like turtle in the gang, an entourage or something.
Turn to page 37 and read it.
And so the principal is taking him down to like the assembly hall where all the teachers are learning that there was an event, which they are calling a sort of terrorist attack, even though no one really knows what happened. And they're already telling us that people are acting disoriented. They're saying strange things, and then they kill themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that makes sense to go to that place first. Because you're not really thinking about electrochemicals and brain in your brain blocking neurotransmitters, which flip off the self-preservation switch immediately.
Right. I'm going to leave that alone.
If you watch the shot, though, you can tell that Shyamalan was really going for the truncated filming schedule, shooting schedule. He shot fast because he had an entire auditorium and he just used as much frame to fill in every single teacher.
Uh-huh.
That was really, really interesting how he did that. You have a big location, and then you just smush them all together. I mean, you don't have to lock up as much. There's less work to do, less lighting. I get it. But it's just interesting how he keeps every shot is very close. And I think that does help with the suspense. You kind of keep it on floor level. So I like that.
So now teacher Marky Mark knows that something's going on. And now we meet math teacher Leguizamo.
I love math teacher Leguizamo. I was so happy.
Why did they make him a mathematician?
Why not?
Because math teachers by nature are not necessarily mathematicians. They're just people who teach math.
I actually taught math for about a month, too. And the person I filled in with was the type of person who's just like, just look in the book.
It's a job. They're not solving postulates like Goodwill Hunting in basements in Harvard.
But this school, though, is very well behaved. I mean, the teachers, one of the guys from Ferris Bueller teaches there. It seems like a very nice school to teach at. I think this school recruits.
I guess we didn't even get into it. For all we know, it's a private school. Yeah.
These teachers care.
The teachers care. Mark Wahlberg cares about the students, the bees. Like,
if this was any other high school, the kids would be rioting.
So Leguizamo's pretty high strung. And now we learn that Mark has to call, and I'm sorry, I don't remember any of the characters' names, and it's not because I didn't like this movie.
So it's Elliot.
Alma.
Alma. And then Leguizamo's name is, I have it written down, cheese and crackers.
I think I got to go with Mark, Zoe, and John.
Mark, Zoe, and John?
Mark, Zoe, and John are going to hit the road. They're going to pick up John Leguizamo's daughter. And apparently, we learn right away more from math teacher Leguizamo than we do from Mark Wahlberg that Mark and Zoe have some kind of marital problem.
Yeah. I don't even think they talk.
At the time, yeah, like something's going on.
I don't think they talk at all.
Like, period?
Like, when you see them together, they do not seem like a couple who knows each other at all. Oh, and Julian. Right. Julian John Leguizamo.
Julian, that's right, Julian. So but later we're going to realize that – so Julian, you know, will later in the movie refer to their wedding day and how he saw Alma crying, apparently – I don't know, the wrong kind of crying before she actually got married to Elliot. I'm actually going to try and use character names here. And you know, it's like, yeah, man, she was never ready to just jump into this. You can't trust her. She's never going to be there for you. And I'm kind of sitting back and thinking, like, all of Julian, math teacher Leguizamo, all of Julian's reaction to Alma always seemed to be a point of hostility and distrust. I feel like if he's such good friends with Elliot – that he would have inherently became friends with Alma. So he must have never liked her.
When they get to the train station, though, he does say, I'm glad you came. Because he was worried that she might not show up. So he did show her that kindness.
But later when she reaches for his daughter's hand, he's like, don't you go for her hand unless you mean it.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe these characters are weird.
They are weird. They're pod people weird.
This is an alternate dimension of people. Right. So if we try to analyze normal behavior, we're wasting our time. Where are all
fair.
The – like we're,
fair.
I mean the bees are probably in a disco lounge somewhere. I mean on this planet. That's what's going on in this movie.
I think if you open Alma, Elliot, and Julian's chest cavities, you'll find that they are clockwork organisms – that are literally being run by bees, like humans inside a Jaeger in Pacific Rim.
Oh, that'd be amazing. That's like the greatest thing ever.
That's where all the bees went. They have overtaken the human bodies and fashioned them into cybernetic vehicles to fight the fight that is coming in the sequel.
Just because the way they talk, just she went on a date with a guy named Tiramisu, and then she always gets her movie references really wrong. Have you like she calls different movies different things. So she might just be a bees in a giant Jaeger.
Right. And so they're trying to escape Philadelphia.
New York.
Right. No, they're in Philadelphia.
They're going to Philly.
They're leaving Philly.
Are they? Because why would they go to New York?
This all started in Central Park, New York.
Yeah, so they're going to Philly.
No, they're going away from Philly.
But why would they go away from Philly then which way are they going?
Because this seems to be affecting major cities, and that's why they were going to the train to go away.
I thought they were going from New York to Philly, and then they stopped on the way to Philly.
No, Filbert is inland in Philadelphia.
Got it. They go to Harrisburg. My bad.
But yeah, so they're trying to go away from all the populated areas because that's what they heard in the news.
Yeah.
And so everyone like Lemmings is following this, and when they do. Alma decides to just circumvent sitting with everyone else, I guess because she's hiding the fact that her phone is burning up from this dude. And then when she's on the phone with the dude on the train, this is one of those conversations where I'm really with you on the fake universe. It's like, really, all we did was have tiramisu. Leave me. It's over. And I'm just thinking, if you just met someone after work and had dinner and had dessert, and when I say dessert, I actually mean a tasty, high-calorie thing that you consumed, and that was it? I don't think you're burning up that person's phone when the apocalypse hits.
Yeah, I think it was a date. They went on a date. Maybe they're, like, work friends, and he finally wore her down, and then she went out with him. Now she's realizing how weird he is. Or this is how everybody acts in this world.
It is weird. Like, I feel like if I was on that date with that person who was estranged from her husband. Boy, I hope I'd never be in that situation. I think I'd just text him and be like, hope you're okay. I'm going to Cleveland with my family. It could just be something like that.
I really don't think Alma and Elliot talk. What would they talk about?
Not much, because when he came home, right when he left the school to gather her so they could like try to leave to go to safety. Like that was like robots having a conversation.
I'm telling you, I think our theory is correct.
With the bees operating them like Jaegers.
And this leads into M. Night Shyamalan's B-movie theory. So we're not hating on the movie. We're just saying we are with M. Night Shyamalan on this trip.
Like B-E-E movie.
Yeah. Seinfeld.
Greatest B movie.
Greatest B movie named B movie.
Better than the B movie that was called B movie.
What's the movie where the little people ride the bee?
I mean, like, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Don't they ride a bee in that movie? And they get a bunch of pollen on them?
I think so. Yeah, they rode a bee. They totally rode a bee in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. They totally rode a bee. So they're leaving. They're on the train. The train is just going to stop.
At Filbert.
In Filbert. And Mark Elliot gets off the train and he sees, like, all these train conductors or something having a private meeting. We learn that communication is down between everyone, air quotes. He's like, where even are we? We're like, Filbert. It's like, Filbert? Does anyone even know where that is?
I feel so bad for his character, though, because all right, he's a science teacher, but he can't have any logical explanation or proof of what's currently going on. But everybody in this movie is like, go find out. Go find out. Go do this. You need to think of something. You need to do this.
And whenever he does it with great confidence, and he's usually on the right track.
He is on the right track. He's the one that figures out that smaller and smaller groups, and they need to keep away from the groups. So I've read reviews saying that he's the dumbest science teacher ever, but everybody goes to him. So maybe he's the smartest person in this world, but everyone goes to him. You're right. When he says we need to get away from all these groups and we need to find a place without roads next to it so we'll be isolated, that's a plan. That's a good plan.
Yep. Especially in this world. So they're in Filbert.
And everyone leaves them.
Yeah, everyone leaves. They go to a diner in Filbert?
Yeah, packed in the diner.
No, wait, hold on. So, right, they're in the diner, and they are watching the news.
Yeah.
They're watching live news, right? So that still works.
And the lion rips people's arms off.
But the train conductor said that communication was down basically in all forms.
Dude, in this world...
Sorry.
TV runs on an isolated bunker network.
I'm being way too... Okay, wait, can we talk about, though, that woman who showed the video of the lion?
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, it's wherever, I don't know, Cleveland, wherever, it wasn't Cleveland. It was, but wherever it was, she's showing, like, this is what's happening in, I don't know, wherever. Maybe it was the Philadelphia Zoo or the Bronx Zoo or something. This dude gets one arm ripped off by a lion and then his other arm ripped off by a lion. And the woman... doesn't even flinch. She just looks at Elliot and says, isn't that terrible? And I'm just thinking, you are a sociopath. You should be flipping your shit at what you are. If I was watching actual news of that, like, it's not even the same as watching someone getting attacked and killed by a lion. Two arms got ripped out of their sockets.
This is an M. Night Shyamalan movie, man. When Bruce Willis realized he could bench 700 pounds, he was like, all right.
Yeah, I was flipping my shit there too, though. And the kid was in the corner of the room. He was flipping his shit. This woman, cool as a cucumber, straight out of the fridge.
I mean, that's M. Night. That's the M. Night world. And we did leave one thing, though. When Mark Wahlberg gets off the train, or when Elliot gets off the train in Filbert, and he goes up to the train conductors, he's like, why are you giving me one piece of info at a time? And I could just think of M. Night Shyamalan just laughing. He's like, I'm giving you little info. Like, I think that's, I mean, M. Night wrote, directed, produced this movie. So I'm just giving you one piece of info at a time. That's what he did in this movie. And I love that scene that he said that.
I feel like I need a Mark Wahlberg sidebar here. Mark Wahlberg, some people think he's a terrible actor. I think I like Mark. Yeah. In movies. I like him a lot. I think he's a great, sincere character. And I don't just mean things like The Fighter or Invincible or things like that. I think he brings a lot of sincerity to his roles. I have never recalled in my life seeing him actively try to act while looking at the camera so hard before in my life. It's like someone was holding his family at gunpoint off camera in real life, and he was nervously trying to – like, I've never seen him try so hard, actively.
He gave this movie his all, and he trusted M. Night Shyamalan, and I bet you he did whatever M. Night wanted. And I was thinking about this as you were talking. If you put together a top 10 Mark Wahlberg movie or performances, you'd come up with a very strong top 10. You got Boogie Nights, Three Kings. I mean, very good movies, man. Invincible – I don't think you could hang around this long if you're a bad actor. So, but I think you're exactly right about what you said about Mark Wahlberg. This dude, he tries so hard in this movie, man. And you can tell he's excited about it because he gets to do something different. I don't think he walked up to M. Night Shyamalan and said, this is what I'm going to do. I think M. Night Shyamalan told him, this is the way I want it. And Mark Wahlberg turned that performance in perfectly.
And then he'd do another take. He'd say, I need you more uncomfortable. I need you more angsty. You're more desperate. You're desperate. You're scared. But you're still Mark Wahlberg and you're sincere. But you're desperate. You're scared. And like, just he is trying to tear his way through that camera lens with his acting.
And at the end, some of the shots, some of the framing, like he does a good job. And I do think
his face acting is on point in this.
My favorite moment, if you want to watch this movie. So they're in Filbert. The power goes down. All the cars leave to go other places. Julian takes off with the dude from Clerks, Dante from Clerks. And Elliot and Alma are picked up by this nice couple who take them back to their nursery to pack up some stuff before they leave to go to more isolated roads. And that's where the mustard line comes up, where this guy talks about how much he loves hot dogs and how they're underrated and how great they are. Then his wife comes up. He's like, hey, you got the mustard? And look at Mark Wahlberg's face when the guy goes to his wife. Hey, did you pack the mustard? Look at Wahlberg's face. It's perfection. You got
it. That guy, though, I recognize that actor from some minor stuff, too. The hot dog nursery guy.
Yeah.
But like that guy, he might have nailed the sincerest role in the movie.
He has a great look, I thought, for the movie. And I thought he was really, the way he delivered his lines, the way he acted, I feel like he was perfect for what M. Night wanted. He was like, almost made to be in an M. Night Shyamalan movie, this guy. I thought he nailed
it. Yeah, and like he had not conspiracy theorist, but his oddly specific and rather out of context, like trivial knowledge about plants and their chemical communication. He really kind of anthropomorphized their communication, but you know, he's just a dude with ideas in a desperate situation. And I see it. It's like when I first saw it, I was thinking like, this is so stupid. And now I'm like, no, this is just a guy. This is just what he's coming up with to explain something that's inexplicable in a desperate situation, and he happens to know a lot of stuff about plants. And now I'm just like, yeah, that's right up there with his hot dogs. I get it. I get you, man.
So his name is Frank Collison, and he was in Silicon Valley, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, ton of stuff. He has been acting for a very long time. But he has a good look, doesn't he?
Yeah, I like him. I could totally see him being a goon in most of his acting roles too. But he's just such an approachable, friendly, trustworthy person. The most human person in this movie, perhaps, and despite his weirdness.
I love what he had to say about plants. I mean, it's thrown in, but he's like, you know, tobacco plants will emit this to keep this off this. Like, I don't know. I liked it. I dug it. Sorry.
Yeah, he really conferred a lot of sentience in his notions. It's like what he was saying were accurate things that were told through, again, like a sentient lens, as if a plant could choose to emit chemicals to summon a particular wasp to attack this particular caterpillar that's attacking me. But in nature, that's basically what happens. Plant gets attacked. When it's attacked, just like a human bleeds, it releases chemicals. Often it's just ethanol. And then the insect's predator or parasite has learned to respond to that chemical because it knows a plant is being attacked as a result. And so it's coming to feed on the thing that is stressing the plant. But this really happens. But I mean, now the plant isn't deciding to throw out an SOS, but all this stuff that he's describing happens. And because he describes it the way he does, I'm sure that most people watching the movie are like, that's ridiculous. It's like, well, the way he's telling it is off, right? That's how I would explain it to a 6-year-old. But all the concepts are actually correct.
So
it was interesting for me to watch this.
And then he went on tirades about hot dogs.
And that was the real truth.
I don't think hot dogs travel well.
I don't know. I mean, they don't rot very quickly. I mean, they don't decompose quickly with all the preservatives in them. like all the fats and nitrates in them.
He loved hot dogs.
We all have our things. You know, some people are just into like sleepless nights, looking out of the window over the city with a big bucket of ribs, and some people just was that Suicide Squad?
Yep. With no silverware or napkins.
Just smacking on some ribs, not even worried about who you wake up with your lips smacking.
That bucket's going to be sticky in Suicide Squad. All the rib.
And then you got this guy with his hot dogs. You know, it's like, who doesn't like hot dogs?
Well, how about this, John? Let's go eat some hot dogs, and then we'll come back, and we'll be even more knowledgeable about plants.
Right, and full of hot dogs. Even more full of hot dogs than before.
Oh. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am full. What about you, John Levengood?
Dude, I'm almost never really full, but as far as reasonable humans go, I probably ate a lot of hot dogs. It's all we had in that toolbox when we hit the road running from the happening.
We probably should have brought water and ice.
And beer.
Yeah, but instead we just loaded what hot dogs we had into a toolbox.
What if being moderately intoxicated, right, basically buzzed, what if that counteracted the chemical reactions that lead to the suicidal tendencies from the happening?
So this is like Grabbers?
Yeah, you just gotta stay perpetually buzzed, but when you stay perpetually buzzed, you slowly get cumulatively more drunk.
I mean, if that's what keeps you alive.
So speaking of what the happening is, I've got a couple more listener questions here, and one of them is very specifically about that.
All right.
So Sarah and her husband Clinton, again from Huntsville, Alabama, ask, what condition were they actually succumbing to? I call it EPCNS, Evil Pollen Cascading Neurotransmitter Syndrome. Yep, Evil Pollen Cascading Neurotransmitter Syndrome. Because in the movie, they suggested that the chemicals and the pollen, right, were disabling in a specific order are neurotransmitters that pertain to self-preservation and presumably some other things in just such a specific order that it resulted in this oddly specific behavior of not just a lack of care, not that they explain this last line of self-preservation, but a desire of self-destruction of sorts. So what's your take on EPCNS?
Man, just when those electrochemicals in your brain are blocked by neurotransmitters, your self-preservation switches off.
I mean, self-preservation doesn't matter. That's just what leads to us being risky.
I mean, I like
this. This is a little more. It's like it disables self-preservation, but then presumably maybe activates something that's homicidal, and then maybe disables our ability to recognize the self, and then perhaps our mind goes to homicidally destroying the self. Like, I mean, if I want to wave my hands in the air, we can rationalize something, right? Like, but I guess part of this that gets to me is that, so apparently we are inhaling or going through our mucous membrane, we are being exposed to this pollen, right? Yeah. Or not necessarily pollen, some semiochemical being released by plants. And it's like, okay. And when it hits you, it just goes, right? That's some potent stuff.
Yeah.
And apparently, at first I was a little confused, right? Remember the opening scene in Central Park where the one girl is acting disoriented before she stabs herself in the neck with her little hairpin thing? But the other girl's right next to her. And she looks around at one point and everybody has frozen. Everyone has stopped moving. And only she on that bench in the center of it all is unaffected. Now, I get that maybe that's just a filmmaking device.
Well, you had to have someone there looking at everything around you.
So would you take that more as a filmmaking device? Because if I'm using what I see on screen to explain the symptoms, I'm thinking like, wait, was she resistant?
I mean, we never get the answer to that, and we never know if there is resistance. I don't think we see any resistance, but it was definitely a filmmaking tool. You just needed someone narrating action. Oh, hey, off screen, people are crawling at their faces. Oh, everyone stopped. I need to watch somebody with the neck. From a narrative sense, it makes sense.
And then they were actually repeated in the closing shot.
when let's oh yeah in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where one guy sees his friend acting funny, then all of a sudden everyone freezes, he looks around, and somehow he was unaffected to be able to perceive this. But again, I'm willing to accept filmmaking device. That's kind of how I took it when I was watching it.
I mean, I guess the construction workers were lower, and they weren't on a roof, so they didn't hit the breeze. The breeze didn't hit them.
And the wind is heavier the greater altitude you get, too. Yeah.
Of course. So, I mean, I guess you could explain that one away, but I don't know. Maybe she, maybe her conditioner was organic honey bound that she got at a farmer's market. And that whiff of real honey, not like a conditioner with fake honey, like a farmer's market honey shampoo and conditioner, bounced the pollen, disaffected the pollen, and led her to be alive for a few minutes longer to narrate all the death.
Or she used herbal essence, and the plants were like, she's one of us.
I think plants would strike out against herbal essence because they know it's fake.
Okay, could be.
I mean, I think if you rub broccoli in your hair, you're safe. I mean, there's no right answer.
You got me thinking about just rubbing little broccoli florets in what little hair I have.
dunk it in some local honey. So, like, let's say you buy some Tupelo honey from Florida and you go back to New York, right? You can't use that there. They're going to know. But if you use some New York honey with broccoli and smack it on your head, you're good. There's no right answer, so we can say whatever we want.
Do you think that if you were afflicted, or me, or if someone was afflicted, right, by these plant semiochemicals or pollen or whatever it is, right, that induces this behavior, this happening behavior, if you were totally restrained, do you think it would wear off after a little bit? I wonder how long it lasts.
That's interesting. So if you were just like hands and legs strapped down, you're able to breathe, you'd probably bite your tongue off. Would you have your mouth secured?
I don't know. Well, I don't know. You're somehow – if someone sedates you for 12 hours.
Oh, there we go.
Like when you come out of it, is this just there? If it's a neurotransmitter thing, presumably your system will recover if you're removed from exposure to the stimulus. There's a lot to explore here.
I would hate to be the last person afflicted before everything went cool. That's interesting, though. If you live and then it stops, would your brain repair?
Like, what if cognitively your attempt to kill yourself failed? What if you jumped off of a one-story building and were just knocked unconscious? And then you're unconscious for like 20 hours. And when you wake up, the happening has ended. Are you just well, concussed, but other than being concussed and maybe having a broken leg, like, are you good? Or do you still wake up with, like, or are you simply afflicted?
I feel like there's no correct answer, so that's why I'm saying I feel. I think once this thing hits you, you're done.
Mark is on record saying you are absolutely done.
And I have nothing to back this up. I have no proof from the movie. I don't even know what affects the people, other than at the end they said they found some stuff in trees. But this thing seems pretty finite. There's no coming back from it.
I mean, you act pretty fast when you're afflicted by it.
Yeah.
People are going and picking up guns.
And they're doing
like someone shoots themselves, they drop the gun. Next person walks up, picks up the gun, shoots himself, they drop the gun. Next person walks up.
It stays very organized. Like, you have enough patience to wait for that. Would people look for better options? By jet ski? Could you get on a jet ski?
It's like, I mean, there's no reason that you're not picking a fun way to die.
I mean, could you get on a jet ski and just ride it into a shark's mouth?
That sounds awesome. That actually sounds pretty bad for the shark.
Yeah, you'd kill a shark.
We're at least going to break its teeth.
Well, how about this? You play the long game. You mess up the shark, then you wait for his cousin to come years later and get you.
Right. Or you go into the Meg. Then you can just go into its mouth.
Yeah, just swallow you whole like popcorn.
Okay, so I've got yet another from Sarah and Clinton. So I got a disclaimer from Sarah before she and her husband submitted these listener questions, and she actually brought up that they were very diatomically opposed in their opinions of this movie. So I'm guessing that one of them loves it and one hates it, or one thinks it's stupid and one thinks it's brilliant. And so this question, I'm guessing, comes from the antagonists of the two. This question is, Mark Wahlberg doesn't seem to know who his character is. If he's a science teacher, shouldn't he act more like a scientist? Now, we got into this a little earlier.
I don't think so.
When we were talking about, like, his science-iness.
I mean, like I
said. And how weird people are acting.
When I taught high school for years, and then around a lot of different types of teachers, I worked with science teachers, and they were just like, read the book. I think it would be pretty annoying if you acted like a science teacher all out of this. And I don't know what science you could have based this attack on, unless they live in an alternate dimension, so their science is different. So I think what he does a pretty good job. I mean, you don't have to act like a scientist to be teaching high school science. So I don't know.
I'm actually going the opposite. I think that most science teachers are by nature not necessarily scientists. And getting a science degree does not a scientist make. You can get a science degree without ever having done science or conducted science. You just learn about science and learn how to test a hypothesis, but that's not the same as discovering, you know, the nature of science, the discovery, the dissemination of new information. So it's, I mean, and then some people happen to have enough science credits and need a job and happen to teach science when really they were a liberal arts major that happened to have a lot of science electives so they could teach science. I mean, I don't think that there's any expectation that a science teacher will be like a scientist. It's just that some of them will.
And so I guess she's asking why he didn't act like that in the movie.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, it's like, you don't know what you're, like you said, it's like, you don't really know what you're going to get with your random science teacher.
Like, I'm a lit major, and if giant books attacked us, I'd be like, I have no idea, guys.
Mark, I wouldn't even call you. I'd just be driving to your place up in Atlanta. Yeah. If books were attacking, I just assume that you were going to book science our way out of this.
Yeah, I mean, I would just buy a bunch of hot dogs and get a large highlighter and hope that they don't want to get their books jacket dirty.
Dude, I'd get white out. Yeah. Dude, just a bunch of white paint.
Yeah, white paint. Yeah, get like a backpack and just like, and whenever they come at you, just spray them.
And put it in a Ghostbusters blaster. Like, I'm just going to hose these book monsters down.
I think we just solved the book monster crisis.
It's like they did in Ghostbusters 2 when they hosed down the whole building.
Yeah, right? Right. Yeah. Yep.
We do that. We'd be doing that to the books.
Yep. They would be like, hey, stop.
Those books are screwed. We got this.
But if books are eating people, wouldn't they have – I guess they would swallow inside the book?
I mean, I think that they would just like smack shut on you. And then just slowly digest you like a Venus flytrap.
Got it.
But right?
Like, yeah. Something like that. Yeah. And it's probably on the pages and chapters they don't like. So they don't worry about getting all their pages dirty.
Yeah, it's like those first couple or last couple pages in a novel.
If I was,
they're just like white flaps.
If I was a book monster, I would be Game of Thrones book 4.
Is that a big one?
You know, it delineates from all the characters and wasn't featured in the TV shows and was a waste of time, and I hate Reddit.
Book 4 wasn't in the shows?
I mean, a little bit, but you have all this crazy stuff happening in book 3. Then book 4 happens. It just goes off on a bunch of side adventures. You are introduced to new people. And then it goes to book 5, which still wastes a lot of time. Yeah, book 4. I'd smush people with book 4.
I've never read the books, but I can't wait until that last season.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Six episodes?
It's going to be like a year from now.
Well, they filmed a 5-month-long night battle scene.
Better be awesome. not that show has ever disappointed me, but that's well, thanks, Sarah and Clinton, and let's get back to speaking of disagreements and relationships. How have Alma and Elliot's relationship been going as this movie progresses?
Well, she is asking him though. She's like, "Why are people being so crappy?"
He's playing some new chemicals.
So what? They're with this group of people. They get off the road because they come up to the military, a guy from the army who says
the cheese and crackers military guy. Yeah.
Then they learn at a crossroads that there's basically they're surrounded. So then they all get out of their cars and they start walking to less populated areas. And they split off into two groups. And guess what happens to the non-Mark Wahlberg group?
Naturally. Wait, can we just address the very technical way that this army guy... when they saw the army guy, by the way, I think it was the guy's wife in the car that they were driving with actually said, "It's the army! We're saved!"
Yeah. And he comes up and he's like, "I have no idea what's going on."
He's like, "Okay, folks, so yeah, it's a good idea. We're going to split up into two groups. All the people who are ready to go now and all the people who need time to gather their things."
Which that makes sense, though, because you know when you've waited for people? You know when you and I were doing Comic-Cons and we had to wait for Dave to get ready for dinner?
Poor David, if you're listening, we love you.
He doesn't listen.
But yeah, I know what you mean.
So, I mean, you know what's crazy? He, without being bullish or without being anything like that, he gets everyone organized pretty quickly.
That's true. And then, you know what? I guess no one is going to be sensitive about, like, why is he going with him? Is it because of this? Is it because I'm a woman? Is it because we have kids? It's just, yeah, it's like, you guys are ready? Let's go. You guys that aren't ready? Hang out and wait for the other people who aren't ready as well, and then you guys go.
That's a good plan. There was no infighting. Everyone kind of understood their different roles of two different groups. And then he pulls his gun out and shoots himself in the head, and then that other group kills themselves.
And so now Julian has split off from the gang for a while now. And we're going to see what happens to Julian when his car, because he's heading back, he was heading back to Philadelphia, and he was saying there's, you know, you want some facts and figures, there's only like a 62% chance.
Yeah, of that thing being hit. How do you come up with that?
Every time he said facts and figures, all I could think is, even if you're a mathematician, that is not your thing. You're acting like a demographer, a sociologist, or a statistician right now.
This is the happening, John. This is an alternate dimension.
But yeah, no, when he came up with 62%, that was one of those moments where I'm like, what?
I was so happy seeing him say this. And I was so mad when Dante from Clerks and he drive their Jeep into a truck and then John Leguizamo slits his wrists.
Dude, he just got – isn't it interesting that Leguizamo chose like the least physically traumatic way? Like he just reached for a piece of glass and went for his wrist. Everyone else is like – crashing cars, jumping off buildings, shooting themselves in the head, stabbing themselves in the throat.
Lions are eating them.
Lions ripping your limbs out of their sockets. And I'm not saying that it isn't going to hurt to slit your wrists. That sounds horrible to me. But it still it was just like a casual little like.
Yeah.
And we know he's going to go.
That bummed me out. I was just happy he was in a big movie.
I like seeing him in everything, man. From John Wick to Two Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar. Sisters or Stepsisters or Amy Poehler and Tina Fey?
Sisters.
Sisters.
There's so many Sisters movies.
I was thinking of Step Brothers, I think, for a moment there. But yeah, he's always a good addition to a movie. Although I've never seen The Jerk or The Pest, I mean. The Pest, I don't think I could watch The Pest.
Yeah, I watched it back in the day, and I didn't really like it when I was 14, so I don't want to see it now.
But yeah, he's great.
Now, I kind of want to talk about they're in the field, there's two different groups, and one of the parts that sort of bothers me the most that Mark Wahlberg gets made fun of a lot is one of the groups starts killing themselves, and everybody in Mark Wahlberg's group starts going, "What are we going to do now? We can't do nothing without you. What are you going to do?" And so Wahlberg's just like, "Shut up, give me a second." And then he says, "Be a scientist, douchebag." I mean... That makes sense, though. He's just like, "Everyone shut up. All right, think. Come on, you idiot. Come on, you know, like, have you ever done that before? Like, come on, think, dude. Just think. Come on, you got this. Like, don't, come on, you idiot." So he calls himself a scientist douchebag, and then he just goes, "Hey, let's get away from them. Let's try to stay ahead of the wind. I don't know how it works, but let's just separate ourselves from more people." And they do that.
Alma had a line that was interesting to me, too. When she was kind of antagonizing him with everyone else, when he kept saying, "Just give me another minute," and you keep hearing the gunfire. And she was saying, "We are not going to be one of those people who just watches a crime and does nothing. We are not assholes." Like, it was, and I get that sense, but it's like, what are you going to do? If you run over there, you will die, too. Presumably.
And he makes the strong decision by going, they're dead already. And they were dead already.
Oh, yeah. What, I mean, once you're afflicted, that seems to it's not like we're going to slap you, slap the sense back into you. It's,
so what was his mission in this movie? It was to keep Zooey Deschanel or Alma and the little girl alive.
And Julian's daughter alive.
Julian's daughter. Yeah. And he succeeded.
Yeah. I mean, that once Julian left them, that really was his aim. I'm going to keep my wife safe. And now I have who is presumably like that might even be his goddaughter. Like that is like a very good friend of his daughter. I'm sure he's seen that child grow up or mostly grow up. And so, yeah,
he succeeds.
And so when they're leaving, they end up at this model home in this new home development area, this little McMansion in the middle of like
nowhere. Filbert. Yeah, Filbert.
in Arundel County or something. And it's like there's fake wine in the glasses and he almost picks it up like he's going to drink it at one point while they're talking about what to do. And before they leave, he sees a plant in the house.
And it's moving because of the air conditioning.
And he looks at it, and because the dude who helped him out earlier, who had the nursery and the hot dogs, talked about how they respond to positive human stimulus, he's like, okay, I'm just going to talk to you in a nice positive voice. I don't mean you any harm. Just want to get my friends and get out of here. Leave you alone to your plant things. This isn't a direct quote. And as he walks closer, he touches it gently like he's petting a stray dog. And it's a plastic plant.
I loved it. I would have talked to him. I would have been like, hey, man, our bad. I'm not trying to, you know, like I would have talked to it.
That's one of those things like where I think that like when M. Night thought of this, he just smiled.
Yeah. Have him talk to a fake plant and realize the air conditioner is blowing on it. It's a funny idea.
Yeah.
Maybe the way he directed the execution was perfect, but it's not a perfect execution.
I honestly love that scene. I sincerely love that scene. And even if you're someone who doesn't like this movie and who wants to make fun of this movie, if you're in that situation and you have experienced what Mark Wahlberg has experienced and heard the hot dog nursery guy say what he said, what else are you going to do? You're not going to bum rush it and you're not going to sprint, I hope.
Dude, you know, hot dog nursery guy. That's my favorite thing I've ever heard.
Hot dog nursery. Like that's now a guy. That is a character. That is an iconoclast that we can refer to 20 pod episodes from now. Like hot dog nursery guy.
And I guess, sorry, going back to the plants, but every other plant that I'm seeing, I would think is eyeballing me. Right.
I mean, it seems like it, right? Because I mean, when they ended up at that house, when they got away from, was it this or was it after they left the house when he wants to stay ahead of the wind, and you literally see wind blowing down the grass and catching up to them.
Yeah.
So they run away from it and I guess outrun or stay in pace with the wind. And then they make it into this big model McMansion house.
I mean, I guess you're not going to stay ahead of the wind, but it makes sense to run because you spend less time. You're further distancing yourself away from people or you're running towards people. But if you're running, it makes sense to run and stay ahead. I don't know.
It was weird. Like, I can see why people might criticize it. But it's like, whatever. Also, if you're in that situation, you are making a decision like that. It's like, shit, wind is coming our way. Just run away. Like, we got to get away from this. I totally get it.
It's a logical decision.
In an illogical situation. Too. It's like it's just one from the wind. I love it.
He makes good moves in this. I wrote, so I have a bunch of notes, and one of my notes is in all caps, and it said sound plan.
Sound plan.
So they're at this mobile home, right? And they leave, and they see a guy doing something pretty gnarly. You want to?
Oh, God, as they're leaving the house, and some other group is approaching the house, and we see them all freeze. And one dude takes a couple steps back and he goes up to the lawn, this big rider lawnmower. And he just reaches over, he turns that thing on, it starts to do a little loop, and he just lays down in front of that thing, like 10 feet in front of it. And this was a trailer moment. This is one of those moments that basically misadvertised the tone of the film, right? where you just think you're getting that the brutal, like you brought up, like this Final Destination scenario, and it just runs over this guy. And before you get the, you know, the really choppy, spray, visceral stuff, the moment that you see any blood start to spray and his legs start to shake, we cut screen kind of tastefully. But I mean, that's one of those scenes, though, where I just sit back and I giggle at some weird stuff, right? You know, my taste in movies. But I just kind of sat back with my arms folded and pressed tightly against my chest and like pressing my head back against the couch. Like, oh, here it comes. It is brutal. Like, can you imagine the melancholy that has afflicted your brain over the course of 30 seconds that you decided to go do that?
That's why I just don't think they're coming back. I don't think they're coming back from this thing because, oh my gosh, well, definitely not that guy. And he just laid there all gracefully.
God, yeah, and he laid down and he actually had one of his arms like above his head. So it was like getting shredded before his head. Like, it just, oh, that thing just, it's going like 5 miles an hour.
That was a good setup. That was a really good setup.
God, yeah, great scene. Good idea.
Oh, yeah.
That scene.
And I think it leads to one of my favorite shots in the movie where it's Mark Wahlberg, two teenagers, Jess and Alma, and they come to this kind of abandoned home and they realize they need some food, so they go to it. And Alma puts the little girl Jess on a swing and it's tied into the tree. And you just have this long shot, or like a wide shot of the tree branch with the holes in it.
And you hear a little crick too. Yeah.
And well, I don't think you should do that. And
I'm not pushing her too hard.
Yeah, like in the but I love that M. Night Shyamalan created tension out of a girl in a swing because you think the tree might be angry that a swing was put onto it. Like that's
I appreciate.
I mean, and then the two teenagers get shot in the face because they stopped acting like humans.
Yeah, I kind of understand that behavior, just that angsty teen, and they were trying to do something good, and they're in a bad situation. They're like, look, dude, don't be an asshole. We have a little hungry girl out here. We just want some food for her, and you won't open the door. But the kid is kicking the door while someone is crazily going on about the poison gas that can get through their wooden blinds, but whatever. And then, out comes the gun barrel, and
two children's head exploded.
That was abrupt. and also it solved a character problem. Not that it was a problem. I liked what those two boys added to it, but it allowed us to simplify down to our core three characters.
And we meet the greatest character of all time.
Oh my God, this old lady with you eyeing my lemonade.
Mrs. Jones.
Was that her name? She was I swear she wasn't right to begin with.
No, I mean she lives miles away from people. She doesn't have a radio. No, she doesn't talk to people for years. You could tell maybe from a picture, a very old picture, her husband probably died many, many, many years ago.
She never reported it and buried him in the garden.
Yeah, she is a mean woman who has anger issues, who doesn't talk with much people, and lives by herself for a reason. And they come across her, and the first thing she wonders is why Mark Wahlberg is Elliot's eyeballing her lemon drink. Are you eyeballing my lemon drink?
No, I wasn't, I swear.
And then she's like, I guess the right thing to do would be make you dinner. And then she hits a little girl.
After they're having a really nice conversation, a nice, sweet, humanized conversation. And the little girl reaches for the cookies after they were invited for dishes. Don't you touch things that aren't yours or something like that. I'm like, what the Christ is this?
And then they go upstairs and Elliot and Alma are whispering and she comes up to him. You want to be, I'll be Mrs. Jones and you can be Mark Wahlberg.
Okay. So I'm just, okay, Alma, we got to get out of here tomorrow morning. Something. We just whisper in a little bit and, oh, Alma, hold on. I heard something in the hallway. Mark Wahlberg looking in the hallway. Oh, there's that old lady. Hey, old lady. Hey, Mrs. Jones.
I hear you whispering. Plan on stealing something?
What? No. No, Mrs. Jones. You got the wrong idea.
Plan on murdering me in my sleep?
Us? No. No. I can't even keep a straight face while I do this.
What?
Me? No.
What? No.
Like, if someone accused you of colluding to murder them in their sleep, I think that your reaction would beget a bit more explanation than me. No, you totally got the wrong idea. That scene's my favorite, though. That's my favorite displaced, unnatural Mark Wahlbergism in this. And I love it, though. I loved it. What? No. And I do get the reaction, too, though. It's just like, how do you respond to this stimulus that you had no idea was coming? Talking about killing me in my sleep.
I wonder if this gave him the seed of the idea for the visit.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. And she was off the whole time. I can see that.
I wish she would have taken off her diaper and smacked it in Mark Wahlberg's face.
Like right on top of his head. And then it oozes down.
Like on the visit.
I feel like, God, we keep talking about M. Night movies. It's like, I want to discuss all the M. Night movies, each in their own episode in the future. Like, I love his movies.
I know we got a bunch of the movie left, but in 2013, I wrote an article about the commercialization of M. Night. And I just said, before The Visit, I'm like, he needs to come back to his lower budget films where he can control the budget. We're not talking $60 million. We're talking $5 million. Then they announced The Visit, which he made for $5 million. And
did he direct that?
Yeah, and then I put it as my most anticipated movie of that year. So I'm telling you, man, I didn't call it, of course, but I said exactly what he should do. And then he's smarter than I am, but then he went and did it. And made me
I loved that movie. That was a lot of fun.
But he went back to $5 million total control, working with Jason Blum, and then that led to Split, and now he's doing Glass. Like, he went back to what he's good at.
Yeah, I'm a little apprehensive about Glass because that's getting big and it's combining ideas. But I mean, I'm looking forward to it, but I'm nervous. Like, I wasn't nervous about The Visit. I wasn't nervous about Split.
I'm kind of happy, though, that he's – I mean, Split, I guess I wasn't nervous about Split. I was very impressed with McAvoy's performance. Holy crap. But so Wahlberg goes to bed. They don't kill the old lady. And I just want to talk about – well, she offs herself. She, like, puts herself in a – he does walk up to a doll, and he goes, Mrs. Jones? That was a bit confusing. But
and then she freaks out on him. Yeah. Like, you got to go now. And then she's out in the garden, and she takes three steps backwards, and we don't see how she kills herself.
But I want to talk about the finale where – and the night before it was established that there was an old – like a old cabin where people could sit in a basement. It was like a slave – not it was like a runaway hideout for runaway slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like a tunnel that you could talk through, and like even if you're 50 yards apart, you can hear each other. And it leads to some very – so the woman dies. Mark Wahlberg or Elliot and Alma think they're going to die. Alma's with Jess. But it leads to some very good shots, and it leads to some good acting with Wahlberg where he starts crying. And there's a really neat shot with just a one shot of him in the corner of this room talking to Alma while she's sitting next to Jess. And also he really lit Zooey Deschanel perfectly in that shot. That Tak Fujimoto earned his every dollar for these shots. But I mean, the story is kind of cheeky. They had a ring, and he said she never talks, I guess, but then he said that the color meant that she loved him, but she was actually horny. I mean, that's all like weird, but I just like the shot that it leads up to, where you have the two of them in their different rooms, and they decide, listen, Mark Wahlberg's like, if I'm gonna die, I'm gonna die with you. They get out, and it leads like to one of the lone like wide shot of the movie of a character. I guess you had this scene before when that guy was getting killed by the lawnmower, but of Mark Wahlberg. And I like how it just went wide with it and showed them walking together. And it was pretty moving to me. I thought it was like a ballsy move. And I feel like his character would do something like that because he's just so damn earnest.
Well, and it really was like, if this is the end, I want to go be with you. And I mean, he just saw the old lady bite it. Right. And they're over there. He's like, shut the windows. Like, maybe they're already exposed.
Yeah.
And maybe he was outside looking at the old lady when she was afflicted. At this point, just depending on the wind or what happened, or maybe that gust already passed, you know, for all you know, we're all afflicted and it's just simmering in our bloodstreams for the next 5 minutes. We don't know how this works, and it makes it terrifying. And I didn't mind the mood ring thing, you know, like, I mean, it was silly, but that's what we do, isn't it? Like, a lot of the most endearing human connections that we make, they're not necessarily from the big bold monologues or deep insights or, you know, wise corollaries. Sometimes it really is just the very human shared moment And it's just one of those little things. And you know, it was sweet. I can see why people would roll their eyes at it, maybe. But now, 37-year-old John looks at this like, that's sweet. I get it. I've had fights and relationships that were resolved with moments like that. You know, it's like, why are we fighting? Remember that time that flippity floppity flip, and it's just some stupid little thing. And I was trying to impress your mother, and I burnt the dinner.
I burnt her house down.
I burnt the house down. But yeah, this movie is good at weird little things. Like, obviously, Mark Wahlberg's Elliot was thinking a lot. He was really bothered about the tiramisu when she explained that she just had dessert with the guy and that was it. And then later, he tells his, like, weird joke of a lie about the pharmacy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I was at the pharmacy. There was a really cute pharmacist behind the counter. So I went up and I asked what the cough syrup was. Didn't even have a cough. Yeah. Then I even went and looked at it. Almost bought it. $6 for a bottle of cough syrup. All that for a superfluous bottle of cough syrup. I'm just like, I'm sitting there loving this silly little thing. And then she cries. This movie's good at weird little things. Even though, for the most part, it's very oddly dehumanized. Like, you know, the people were acting weird, as we've said. It has its heartfelt moments, and they're worthy.
And it leads to a very good shot of the two of them walking towards each other. I think is earned. So, I mean, yeah, man, dude, I like this scene. I like Zooey Deschanel a lot in this. And I thought just the lighting of the two. I want to find a screen grab. I might just take a picture. I don't know what I'll do. Maybe go online, try to pull a grab. But there's a couple shots in here that I thought were really beautifully lit. And, yeah, and it leads to a happy ending.
Oh, and whenever you get a close-up of her face with a forlorn look, her eyes have a shine to them like a Disney animal.
And Mark Wahlberg, he had like very good, like, there's moments where his pupils just look totally black. Like, I noticed, like, when his pupils get wide, like, he could do a horror movie pretty good, I think.
Or some of those Disney animals have largely black eyes, like Thumper.
Oh yeah.
I could see him as Thumper.
But no, you know what though? You're right, because Deschanel was known for Good Girl being a smartass, Big Trouble being a smartass, Elf being a smartass. This was a different kind of role for her. I mean, she was still very quirky, but it wasn't her typical pithy role at the time.
It was completely uncomedic.
Yeah, and there was no. She didn't roll her eyes a lot. There was just two earnest weirdos who were learning to fall back in love.
Her only typical moment was when she's saying it was just tiramisu. Yep. That's it. And that's before what was at stake really came super close to home for them.
And I kind of like that instead of the tiramisu, he was just mad that she lied to him. Like, you lied to me?
Yeah. That's it.
And then also, come on, Roland, get him. See, we're normal. We're totally normal.
Yeah, we're totally normal. I'm just singing out here.
When he tries to be normal.
You want some Funky Bunch? You want me to cover the wild side?
They're just two weirdos. They're two weirdos who fall in love at the end. And it just takes them to get on their own, kind of maybe rediscover each other during a cataclysmic event.
And now they have adopted Alma.
Wait, Jess.
Jess, I'm sorry, Alma and Elliot have basically adopted Jess as we – I don't know how forward we flash, because it's not like a day. The kids are back in school.
3 months.
It on screen say that? Okay. So they're taking care of the child, and of course the Northeast. Has the population dropped by like 80 or 90% in the Northeast? Like,
yeah, I don't know how things would be able to function within 3 months.
I mean
– trash, cleanup. I mean, I'm sure all these people, there was
God,
probably,
the bodies, dude, the bodies.
I mean, there must have been millions of people in cars who crashed into each other.
Dude.
This sounds like a post I should write about, you know, dumb data. But yeah, I mean, I guess 3 months, but in this world, they're hyper efficient. Everything's rolling back. Everything's great. And she goes to school, and then we find out that Alma is pregnant.
Well, actually, and that was very sweet. But you know, I guess, though, when you look at whatever portion of America was unemployed and looking to relocate for work, well, all of a sudden, I'll bet there was a presidential address a week after the happening of like, okay, here's our stimulus package. I'm going to give this to the public schools and this to the whatever. And the local government was probably advertising a lot, and a lot of people suddenly got jobs. The happening wasn't a pollen attack. The happening was reducing the unemployment margin.
Thanos would be proud.
That's what happened. Thanos would be, dude. Thanos would be taking panic breaths of that.
No, man, you know, after talking about this movie, I love this movie. I think M. Night Shyamalan went out to make this movie, and he made this movie. I don't think this was a misfire. I think the idea was a bit misguided, but I don't think he misfired. I think he made exactly what he wanted with this film.
I think that when I saw this, you know, 27-year-old John, when he saw this in 2008, I think that my biggest point of contention or eye-rolling was its lack of seriousness with respect to the majority of his films. I think that that's what surprised me. Just that this was so out there, and some of the characters were in such weird situations that I just wasn't expecting such a curveball. I figured after Lady in the Water, we were going to come back to serious, and we kind of did, but it was a bonkers premise.
Yeah.
I had trouble wrapping myself around it at the time. And this is another one of those movies. Actually, and I said the same thing in our last episode about the Fright Night remake. This is one of those movies where at first I was apprehensive or liked it less, and every time I watch it, I like it more.
Because maybe you're right. The first, you know, there was a downslope for M. Night Shyamalan. People didn't know what to expect, and then they just kind of didn't give it a chance, and then it became easy to make fun of. But I do think it's worth a critical revaluation. So he swung big and he missed, but I think he still connected with a lot of people.
I got to tell you, when you several weeks ago dropped your article about the 10th anniversary of The Happening, I felt like we had a mood ring moment like Alma and Elliot. And I'm just like, holy shit, you like that movie too?
Yep. And I don't want to hate on it. I just wanted to write about why I like M. Night Shyamalan, because he took a risk with this movie, man. And you don't see many things like this. And like they said, you just can't explain it. It's an act of nature. You can't explain it.
Yeah,
but I love it.
And I didn't mind how they had that guy on the news at the end basically repeat the exact line of that student with the perfectly symmetrical face in the beginning, where he repeated the exact quote. It was an act of nature we'll never understand. I like that. That felt like a writing device that isn't even a line of dialogue, but I liked its placement.
I don't know if that scene was needed, because it did feel a bit overkill, because they could have just cut to Paris.
Where it happens again. Is that the sequel's title? Wait, I can't. We have a listener question about it, so I shouldn't say
Yeah, let's do it. All right, what's the question?
So. Okay, so we have a few questions that are basically looking back at the movie. One of them is from Colm Sanderson from Tasmania on Twitter. That's Kalfa5. And Colm asks, why do I love this movie and nobody else does? Well, Colm, I think that in 90 minutes we've already answered that you're not alone.
I think he gets it. I think you get it.
And, you know, it's easy to be judgy about movies. I do it all the time. And with this one, I found myself erring on the side of judging lighter, and it really improved my enjoyment of it.
This movie's something special. And even though I didn't start thinking critically about it until, you know, I started writing about it again, but I've always respected this movie because it's so different. It's unlike anything we've seen. M. Night Shyamalan told a bonkers story, and we don't get this much. So just on that fact, I respected it and liked it. And I think you thought outside the box and just didn't immediately try to hate it. And we applaud you.
Yeah. Yeah, Colm, we're with you. And Sarah and Clinton have more questions for us as well from Huntsville, Alabama. Was M. Night Shyamalama Ding Dong trying to send a message with the plot, or was it simply a movie?
He was driving home and he saw plants. He saw trees blowing in the wind.
But I mean, in execution, maybe. Once he sat down to really to elucidate the plot. I actually think that he was taking what would be a message and just making a movie.
Yeah,
because he didn't really – there were no lines. I mean, there was like one line maybe at some point that I can't even remember about nature, you know, the plants exacting their revenge, and it was like that was it. It was like a line. But there wasn't stuff – there was no exposition about what we've done to the planet. There was no exposition about what we've done to bees or pesticides or deforestation or recycling or being good people, being moral people, being eco-friendly people. There was like not a line about any of those things. At one point, there was some line that wasn't even very heavy-handed, that I can't even remember it, that was just saying that this is the, you know, this is the plant striking back and this was a warning, something like that.
And people would say that.
Right.
People, like, if someone out there, and they're like, well, all right, so if someone just sat down and went, not in this world because no one thinks rationally, but if someone just saw, hey, people are getting killed right there because of that wind, I'm not getting it here, this means there's something in the wind, and it's probably attacking, and somebody's mind would go there. So it's totally, like, it's not a preachy moment, it's what somebody would say in there. And I took this more of a very tight-knit story about two people and how – you know, they both had they seemed to have like some sadness in their life. They weren't communicating. You know, maybe there was some depression and they just kind of went further away from society, realized people are crazy there, then, you know, came back and made a life of it. I think it's a much smaller story than a global catastrophe.
I'm with you. I mean, this felt like zero allegory and all heart.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And I like that. Well, and then we have one last question, and this is where I had to cut myself off earlier, also from Sarah and Clinton. What would the sequel look like? They show us France at the end.
Gosh, I mean,
it happened again.
Well, they do that though, right?
Still happening. Right, and it's 3 months later.
Yeah, I mean, it would be much more gratuitous. It would be much bigger. There's obviously a global something going on. Man, it would just be bigger. It would be more scientists unless you kept
because people would have been spending the last 3 months pelting out published papers about the happening and analyzing what happened and even looking at sociological effects of it, fear aftermath, economics, plant stereochemistry. So the world would be – we would only have 3 months, but still the world would be more in the know.
I think once this thing hits and this massive pop – it seemed like a much more widespread area too. There's no getting out of Paris at this point. So it might just be if that's where it's taking place, it might just be a smaller scale type film. I mean, who knows? Maybe it changes something in their brains where the people don't kill themselves. They start killing other people.
It turns into like Mayhem or The Signal.
28 days later. Yeah. Mayhem. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like Mayhem. Signal. Oh, I like The Signal.
I remember coupling this with The Signal. Not The Signal that was the alien and Lawrence Fishburne, but the 2000, I want to say, 7-ish.
Like the anthology type.
No, the Signal was about radio waves that made you murderous.
Yeah, but they had different segments. There was the there's different setups in it. It had like the different parts had very different personalities to them.
But yeah, it's like I could see that where it has to, I mean, because you can't just do more of the same.
Yeah. I kind of like the idea of making it smaller and just trying to survive in Paris. Like, how would you even do that? I think that could be an interesting thing, or just trying to, like, because it's so populated. It seemed like there was a pretty big break around. Like, Wahlberg was able to get out of there on a train pretty early. So they got out pretty early. And as soon as that thing hits Paris, you know, everyone's going to flee because they know the situation. And then that's going to be bundled up with people. I don't know, man. A survival film in Paris.
Bunch of people are trying to take the tube over to London under the Channel.
Ooh, that'd be pretty safe, right?
I don't know. And unless something, like, afflicted you right before the tube went under. And then you have, like, chaos on a train going high speed under the English Channel.
People, actually, someone brings a cactus on the train.
Just like overhand, like hook shotting that cactus at other people. Like high lie, like they're playing high lie with a cactus. Like it hits someone in the chest.
Yeah, and then they go crazy.
Oh, right, because the cactus is infected.
Yeah, it's So everyone's just like, everyone's safe. Then you cut over to the one person, like the hitman who has his fern, like in The Professional. Or, you know, there's a bunch of anti-planters who are trying to burn down all the plants in the world.
A lot of potential lunacy to this already crazy concept.
any plugs before we end this thing?
You know, this week I just want to say thanks to our listener question submitters. We had a nice little diversity from a range of places. So there was Dan Robinette, who, again, independent filmmaker. I loved his short film Tethered was really, really harrowing. It was probably the best short film I saw in the last year or so. I saw it at Shriekfest, and he got me invited to that. And John F. Leonard, again, author. You can find his horror and thriller writings on Amazon. He's John_F_Leonard on Twitter. Sarah and Clinton from Huntsville, Alabama, a married couple that was a house divided about The Happening. Hopefully, like Alma and Elliot with their mood ring revelations, we have you two walking across the living room towards one another with wanton eyes as you listen to the close of this podcast. By the way, I think I've said it before, but Sarah's brother, who we lost about 10 years ago, was one of my dearest college friends. So, Kevin, I miss you very much. And Colm Sanderson from Twitter, he's at Kalfa with a C5, and he's from Tasmania. So thanks again from Colm, who loves this movie just like we do. You're not the only one. And yeah, that's what I got, Mark. I'm grateful for our listener questions. And guys, please keep giving us more. Sarah and Clinton, the next time you disagree about a movie, tell us, and we will therapeutize your way through, out another word. We're going to therapy the shit out of it. Mark, closing thoughts? What are we doing next episode? Do you have any plugs? Can they find us somewhere?
Yeah, so you and I, it's going to be a little while, but we have Valerian.
Valerian, in-person podcast.
And you're going to be here. So you, Megan, and I are going to sit around, and we're going to be in the same room talking about Valerian.
We are going to be running around the room talking about exploding heads during fishing mishaps.
Oh, man. I love Valerian. So send us any questions on that. Also, watch it. It's on Amazon Prime. Head to iTunes, Movies, Films, and Flicks, FLIX. Rate, review, and subscribe. We'd love to know what you think. Also, head to the site, moviesfilmsandflicks.com, FLIX. And follow us. Check out our articles. We write a lot. You can find everything we write. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Thank you for listening to the podcast. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for John Levengood, see you when we talk about Valerian. And this is Movies, Films, and Flicks.